This is a lecture given by Swami Ashokananda on Sunday, October 23rd, 1960. And it's called How to Break the Power of Karma. The subject is how to break the power of karma. But before one can speak of how, of course, you understand it is necessary that one should explain what this karma is. No doubt many of you have heard or read about the law of karma, which is thought by Hindus and Buddhists and Jains to be so important. I may say emphatically that it is as truly a law as the law of gravitation, or any other law by which this world and this life are governed. When we think that certain phenomena in nature are behaving in a way which cannot be changed without destroying the very nature of the phenomena, we call this uniformity of behavior a law. Every physical phenomenon has its peculiarity of behavior and is found in certain respects to agree with other physical phenomena. Well, when we enter our inner life, there also we have found that this kind of law exists, that the behavior of the mind is governed by a peculiar law, which is called the law of karma. That is to say, we accept it as law that a causal relationship is established between our action and the fruit of our action, and that we cannot avoid this fact as long as the mind exists. The idea has been expressed variously in different parts of the world. In Christianity, for example, the traditions of which are well known to you, the law of karma may not be specifically defined, but it is definitely there. And there is this quotation, "As you sow, so shall you reap." That is, in effect, the law of karma itself. Christians also accept this causal law as a fact that cannot be violated. And of course, whether or not we know such a law has been defined, in actual practice, we all believe it implicitly. All our actions would become meaningless if we did not believe that they would leave an effect on our mind and on our life. Our education would have no value at all if we did not depend upon the fact that whatever we impress on the mind becomes a part of our memory and to that extent influences our mind and our knowledge. We all believe that whatever we experience becomes a part of us. It is true we don't try to apply it consciously to everything we experience. When we experience a good thing, we wish it would always remain ours. But when it comes to the bad things, we think they don't have to be a part of us. We can just forget them and there's the end of it. But there is no end to it. The law will work on both sides. If you possess the effect of a good experience, then to the same extent, you will also possess the result, the effect of an unhappy experience. You cannot escape it. And this is the law of karma. The idea of karma originated in India in very ancient times, even in the time of the Vedas. Some scholars disagree and claim that the people of India came to believe in this law later on. And they say, oh, we cannot do anything. This is our karma. That's why we suffer. So you hear sometimes that India is, the conditions in India, at least partly traceable to the belief in this law of karma. Whereas personally, this is Swami Ashokananda talking, personally, I do not think for a moment that this is so. Whereas the people in India believe in this law, we also have another belief along with it, and that is the doctrine of the invincibility of the individual soul. We say, yes, our mind is governed by the law of karma, but we are not the mind. You know how often that you have heard from us, and you have read in the Vedanta texts, that the true person is the spirit, and he is perfect from beginning to end. There's nothing imperfect about the spirit. We suffer here only because we have forgotten our true nature and are too much interested in the mind and the body. If we would just stop a minute and look at ourselves, this moment we could be free. Well, at the outset of this lecture, I'm giving the answer as to how we can break the law of karma. And that answer would then be just deny it. But denial should be deep denial, not superficial, not mere forgetfulness. You have to learn to live independent of the dictates of the mind, and also, of course, independent of the dictates of the body. But if you have become independent of the mind, you can very easily become independent of the body. That's only a byproduct. You see, this is the way that Hindus think. However, I shall come to this point later on in greater detail. Let me go on about explaining karma in a methodical way. The Sanskrit word karma literally means action or work, but our ancient books have used this word in different ways. For example, in the Bhagavad Gita, you will find two uses preeminently. In one sense, any kind of work you do is called karma. In another, rather restricted sense, karma is ritualistic action, the performance of Vedic ritual. We shall forget this restricted meaning. We'll not consider that. We are concerned with the first definition. The theory here is that whenever you do any action, whether with the body or the motor senses or with the mind, that action or that karma leaves an impression on the mind. That's important. Our sages and philosophers have laid great stress upon karma as impressions. And it is in this sense that the word is included in the term the law of karma. Here, karma is not actual work or action, mental or physical, but the impression of an experience, the impression created by an experience. Action itself is not so superficial as we make it out to be. Often I have thought I would speak on the subject, what is action? We don't think about it. We are always active, and it seems so natural that we never ask ourselves, what is this action? A moment's thought will convince us that we are being forced to act. Bodily, you may be able to sit still, but mentally, it's not so easy to be quiet. I mean, as long as you are conscious, It is difficult to still the body, and infinitely more difficult to still the mind. So we should ask, what is this force which is keeping us so restless and over which we seem to have so little control? The nature of this mysterious force that makes us do or say or think is worth inquiring into. The fact is, however trivial or seemingly trivial an action may be, the motive from which any action rises is very deeply laid in our being. Therefore, its effect cannot be superficial, but must also be very deep. One thing to remember is that whether it is deep or superficial, the effect will remain with us as an impression. You cannot erase the impression unless you deliberately do something to nullify it. Now consider how many experiences we're having every moment. Practically speaking, every moment our experience is changing. We are not the same in our thought or action for any 2 seconds. And all the immeasurable experiences we are having leave their impressions on the mind. Some of them we notice, others we don't notice. But the conscious mind can hold only one experience at any given time. So with each new experience, the impression of the previous experience is thrust downward. This process is constantly going on. Then, where do these impressions go? We say that every impression goes into the unconscious part of the mind. It doesn't go at once. For a while, it remains close to the threshold of consciousness, and that is why you can easily remind yourself of a recent experience. In other words, your memory remains fresh and you can call back that experience vividly, but slowly, slowly it begins to go down, unless it is a particularly impressive experience and has a special reason for staying close to the conscious mind. I shall come to this aspect of karma later on because there is an interesting point connected with such impressions. Here I should remind you of the fundamental conclusion of our philosophy and religion about the mind. As I said, the real person, that is to say, this self-conscious being who talks, who listens, who does things, avoids things, seeks things, success and failure, the real person is the spirit. And the spirit has nothing to do with the mind. That is a crucial point. The spirit has nothing to do with the mind. It is independent and perfect and does not seek anything. It does not suffer, it does not enjoy. If you say, what kind of perfection is that where I don't enjoy anything? Well, you will know if your mind becomes a little quiet, you will find you don't have to seek anything. There is something more blissful than enjoyment or so-called happiness as we know it here. It is enough for me to say that if you want to think anything extraordinary and wonderful about yourself, all those things within yourself are already there. And many more that you cannot even imagine now. So when you become involved in the mind, you do not gain, actually you lose. The mind is, as it were, a cloud covering the shining sun. The cloud has dimmed the sun's glory for you. It has not added anything to the sun. Both mind and body are limiting adjuncts, as we say, and the real person, the free and perfect spirit, is the seat of consciousness. The mind is not the seat of consciousness. The light of the spirit is reflected upon a part of the mind, and that part becomes what is called the conscious mind. That is, only the part of the mind where the light of the spirit is thrown becomes conscious. The rest of it, the rest of the mind, remains dark and is called the unconscious mind. Now, this is it. If all these impressions are there, you must understand that there is tremendous complexity as well as great depth in the mind, because innumerable motives or springs of action exist in the unconscious part, and innumerable impressions are continually going there into that unconscious part. You can see that without some sort of order, some law governing these motives of action and rearranging these impressions, our mind would explode to nothingness through sheer revolution or chaos. But as it happens, a certain order in the mind is maintained. For example, if you ask about the spring of action, it can be put very briefly. If I am to speak of anything about karma, it becomes complex. You will excuse, therefore, if I go over certain aspects of it quickly without being too explanatory. No doubt many have read Patanjali's Yoga Sutras and remember the definition of Ishvara or God as is given in that book. Ishvara is called a Purusha Vishesha, a special person, a special being, to give a literal translation. Yoga philosophy follows in the footsteps of the Sankhya philosophy, which explains life and the world in terms of Purushas, innumerable souls, and Prakriti or nature. So souls and nature, undifferentiated matter, without mentioning, they do not mention God. But yoga adds that there is a sort of Ishvara, not the God of the theists who has created the world and punishes people, but just a most perfect being. According to this definition given by Patanjali, this Purusha is a special personality who is unaffected by avidya or ignorance, and therefore unaffected by the things that follow from that ignorance. That is to say, klesha, that is suffering or misery, karma, action or the effect of action, vipaka, fruition of action or maturity of the impressions of action, and asaya, the vehicle through which these impressions begin to have their effects. Well, here Patanjali has put together all the ways by which an average individual is afflicted after having somehow become entangled in this avidya or ignorance. This is how it happens. As a result of ignorance of his true nature, the person has suffering, that is klesha. To get rid of this suffering, he indulges in activity, karma, which leaves impressions on the mind. Then these impressions begin to mature, and that is called vipaka. Literally, vipaka means well-cooked. As it were, somewhere in the unconscious mind, some of these impressions begin to boil or to cook. And when they have been well cooked, they are ready. That is to say, they will affect your life by coming into your conscious mind. When, as it were, you consume that or you follow that, this is called asaya. You know, in terms of food that is prepared or cooked, some dishes are not bad, some are good, but others are not good at all. They're awfully bitter and ill-prepared. It isn't that they have not been boiled enough, that is vipaka, but the ingredients give you indigestion. In this way, life is not always smooth. Now, these are the means by which every soul becomes afflicted. And God is not touched by any of these, according to Patanjali's idea of Ishwar or the Lord. We are not concerned with Ishwar in this lecture, but we are really interested in all that Patanjali has said here, because in these few words, he has gone into various aspects of karma and its effect on us and the way it functions in our life. Now let us go back to the simple narrative. As I pointed out, some impressions remain close to the threshold of your consciousness. And even if you don't recall them, they come up in your memory. In a humdrum life, most impressions go down and get lost in the unconscious. And yet some force makes us go on following a certain course of action in our life from day to day until the time comes for us to disappear, to die. You know, our view about reincarnation, and you have also heard that the real person, the spirit, in this present state of ignorance remains still attached to the mind and goes out with the mind at death, leaving only the physical body behind. The mind will cling to the spirit until the spirit has found complete spiritual knowledge and has actually come to the realization, to the experience, that the self or the spirit is not a part of the mind, is not one with the mind. The spirit has, in fact, nothing to do with the mind. So at the time of death, a person carries with himself all the infinite impressions of experiences that are lying in the mind. Here we come to a strange thing that we generally, in Hinduism, we generally believe. But when you think about it, you will see good reason for that belief. They say that just before a soul passes away, it has a preview of where and how it is going to live in its next birth. According to the doctrine of reincarnation, a soul may remain for a long, long time in one of these planes of existence above this earth, until it is reborn. How then can it have this prevision of its next incarnation at the time of death? This is the explanation of it, and it is good to remember here. At the dying moment, when you are leaving this house called the body and have to take this mind with you, you become aware of its terrible burden of impressions and experiences. The Hindus maintain that all the events of the life that is coming to an end pass before the view of the soul like the quick showing of a film, and the soul is made to go through every little experience. There is reason to believe this idea has some truth in it. You have heard of drowning people having had this kind of experience before they were rescued. It is, as it were, you are leaving a house in which you have lived for years. Maybe you have forgotten many things you had put away in your attic and basement, but now you bring out all your possessions and examine them to decide which you will discard and which you will keep to furnish the next house you rent. At death, we make this kind of choice. We, as it were, sort out what we have bought, what we have done and experienced in this life, and then we decide, in the next life, I'm going to do this and this. They say this is one reason why we have a preview of our next life sometimes. Another reason given is that whether this selection happens at the dying moment or not, as we live through our life, certain desires become strong. When we reach the conclusion of life, these desires come preeminently to the forefront of the mind and seem to dominate everything else. All other things are forgotten. Maybe these strong desires have remained unfulfilled in this life. Therefore, we want to pursue them again at the next opportunity. Or maybe they were partly fulfilled by the time death intervened, and we would like to have them more satisfactory, more thoroughly satisfied in the next life. You know how even in our lifetime, when certain motives become strong, they have a way of thrusting other motives into the unconscious. It is quite imaginable that when these strong desires are occupying the conscious mind, dissimilar tendencies will have no chance of coming, of arising. Suppose, for example, you are an intellectual person, a student of philosophy, but suddenly you get the idea you want to be a painter. How much philosophy do you think you can read anymore? Day and night, you are using, you're working with your colors and bringing people to look at your work. You are swallowed up by the idea of becoming a painter. It is said that the dying moment, similarly, some desires come forward and determine what we are going to be like in the future. This is the way desire acts. Now, you remember I said that some order is maintained among the infinite number of impressions in the unconscious mind. What happens is this. When you have an experience, its impression goes down into the unconscious and somehow ranges itself by the side of similar impressions that we have gathered in the past. And they join forces, as it were, and become codified and classified to form what we call the traits of our character, our habits and tendencies. We like to do things in a certain way. We want to look at things in a certain way. We hate certain things, we love other things. And such tendencies have been formed throughout many past experiences. The most predominant tendencies in the unconscious mind are governing our conscious mind or conscious life, and it is these which take the form of desire. One important point I should mention here is that every experience has the potency of repeating itself in a similar living experience. Of course, if a good experience has left its impression, you want it to be repeated. Suppose I am a pilgrim searching for a saint who has actually realized God, and after traveling hundreds and hundreds of miles, I have come upon a real saint. Of course, that's a wonderful experience to have, and one would like to repeat it. Or suppose you have a very good meditation one morning. It is very desirable that the impression it has left should repeat itself as a living experience. But then most people are in the state of ignorance, and the tendency of the mind is to go downward, not upward. Even their happy experiences are not necessarily very elevating. It is enough to say that we probably would not like to repeat most of our experiences. Anyhow, these impressions lie there and have the tendency and the power of reappearing as living experiences later. Most of the time we act instinctively, that is to say, we do not want to face whatever we are going to do or experience, and we just succumb to what is coming to us. Whatever the mind is bringing out, we identify ourselves with that. But you know, we don't have to do it. Many people think we are absolutely in the hands of karma. You should never forget, you should never get this idea. In India, we have never interpreted karma in that way. In other words, karma does not imply fate. A fatalist will say, oh no, I cannot change, I am fated to be like this. He persuades himself that there is something inevitable about this. There is actually nothing inevitable. The Lord Buddha, who was such a sane person, so rational, he said, yes, your present is caused by your past, but your future will not be caused by your past. Your future will happen according to your present. If you work rightly now, if you think rightly now, your future will change. There is an art by which you can change your future. For example, to get rid of a certain bad experience or bad tendency, you try to do the opposite. You might wonder, can I do it? If my conscious mind is occupied with and overwhelmed by certain tendencies or desires, how can I think of the opposite kind? Oh, yes, you can. The mind has wonderful flexibility, and this ego, this I sense, this self, is the extraordinary sense. Also, it has many wonderful opportunities of manipulating the mind. They say one of the easiest ways to overcome wrong things within yourself is to find someone who represents what you're trying to achieve and stay near that person. And that is a fact. You have to put yourself, in other words, in the right kind of environment. But if you cannot go from place to place to find that environment, then you have to make your own environment by means of study, by means of thinking. Struggle in your own mind. Read the lives of the saints and of the sages. Try to produce that state of mind opposite to the state you're trying to conquer. Slowly you will find that you're able to prevail against that which seems to be so strong. And you can bring forward your own desirable thoughts and emotions and motives. If you believe in God, as most of us do, you should pray to God. You should pray sincerely and be sure that you can be sure that the Lord will respond to your prayer. Don't be so arrogant as to set any time limit for him. We always think, I have prayed, next morning the result should come. Why should the Lord take your dictation? Is he your servant? Why do you think God will respond just because you are kind enough to pray to him? But wait, a great deal of patience is necessary. Tolstoy once wrote a book called, in translation, 23 Tales. It reads almost like a scripture. You may remember that the theme of one story was that God listens to our prayer, but he responds a little late, not at once. This is a profound truth. Well, you pray, you will find that your conditions are changing as a result of this prayer. But I must warn you, this is a difficult game. It is not done in 2 or 3 days. If you say it is hard to believe that I can conquer the mind, I have been struggling, but I am reaching nowhere. Well, right, everything has its method. In a battle, if the general is intelligent enough, he keeps watch to see that the enemy does not come from the rear and surround his army. Now, do you do that? You are struggling about one thing, but you are letting the mind run off in wrong directions. Well, you have to alert the mind about that, and then you will succeed in whatever you undertake. There are two alternatives before us. One is to become impatient or hopeless and succumb to whatever comes into the mind. It goes without saying that you have no hope there. The other way is to be bold enough to say, no, I know it is a steep climb, but cautiously, step by step, I shall go upward. Mankind has been given that power of achieving victory over his karma. And don't forget, whatever difficulties may be involved in such achievement, the victory brings more than the expected reward. Not only you win your victory, but by the very fact that you have the courage and determination to struggle, you gain liberation. When a person courageously undertakes a struggle in the name of something good and ideal and says, I shall fight against these wrong things, however strong they are, that person has at once asserted his true nature. To affirm your independence of body and mind is the real great gain. So many struggles come in the lives of those who are seeking God that people often wonder, what is the use of being spiritually minded? It seems that life is more unbearable for them than for the worldly minded. You are declaring the victory of your true self over the mind and the body. That you're trying to conquer a trait of your mind is only an excuse. The Lord is giving you a much greater victory, victory over the whole mind and the whole body. Therefore, devotees of the Lord suffer much, but it is not mere suffering. They suffer with a purpose and with a method. That is how the mind is conquered, and that is how karma is conquered. To go on now with the story of the mysterious karma, that is to say, those desires that occupy the stage of our mind. You remember I quoted from Patanjali, who said that there are certain things that affect the soul, klesha, karma, vipaka, ashaya, and that the soul has forgotten its true nature. Ashaya is the course of action or karma that we see in our life. But before that course of action can take place, this karma has to mature. And this maturing process is called vipaka. I have also said that karmas, or the impressions of experience, sometimes combine together and become what is called tendencies, or as we say, samskaras. These groups of karma remain in the unconscious mind until they become strong enough to take the form of desire. That is when they are said to have reached maturity, the stage of vipaka. That is to say, they are sufficiently cooked. Then they begin to thrust forward into our conscious life, and that is called ashaya. Before vipaka, there is only karma. And before karma, we have klesha or suffering. But these all arise, as I said, from avidya. If we had not forgotten that we are spirit and nothing else, then we would not have suffered. We would not have tried to avoid this suffering by undertaking different actions, which left their own impressions on our mind, while biding their time to become mature and take possession of our conscious life. None of these things would have happened, but as it is, we are identified with the mind and with the body, and as a result, these several things are happening to us. After ignorance, if you are to name the next deep-seated source of karma, it is klesha, or misery, and its opposite is happiness. We try to avoid what brings us unhappiness, and we go after what makes us happy. Why are we continually following in the train of happiness and misery? We don't know. Animals, lower types of humanity, and even many civilized people are governed by this motive. You consider the pursuit of happiness as an inviolable right, which is fine, unless you want to make it an ideal of life. The fact is, only in the lower form of existence can happiness be a strong motive. At first, there is this hedonistic motive. Afterwards, another motive begins to intervene, the moral motive. In a civilized, thoughtful person, both motives are there. Sometimes a person knows he must suffer because of his sense of right and wrong, yet he will act according to the moral motive. But most often, people are governed by what gives them pleasure and pain, and they undertake certain actions accordingly. Either this moral motive or the motive of pleasure or pain, or both motives combined, give a boost to our desires. At any time in our conscious life, we may say either this is my duty or I like to do this, I must have it. Well, there it is. Whatever, according to whichever motive we are working, the desire in our unconscious mind will have an opportunity of coming into the conscious mind and dominating our action. Here I should put before you certain other ideas. This law of karma has been studied in great detail by our philosophers, both in Hinduism and in Buddhism. For example, they speak of another way of looking at karma. I have said that karmas rise from the unconscious to the conscious mind in the form of desires. You might ask, how do you know which desire will come up? And if there are, say, two equally strong desires in the unconscious, which one would have precedence? So our thinkers have judged karma, that is to say, karma is the effect of action, from three standpoints. They have found certain karmas have already matured and started dominating our life. These karmas are called prarabdha, that which has well begun. I told you that when a soul passes from this body, it has a preview of its next birth. And when the time comes to assume a new body, it will be born under the impulse of these dominant motives. In the intervening period, when the soul remains in another world, these strong motives live there, biding their time. You cannot do anything about them. They have the precedence, and no other thoughts or karmas are able to replace them. When the time comes to be reborn, they will have their opportunity and will seek parents and environments and situations suitable for their fulfillment. Like is drawn to like. If you say that's too subtle a thing, it seems to us that the choice must be haphazard. Then I shall remind you that we live in this life. A stranger comes to the city, he has a certain character, certain tendencies, and wants to indulge in or achieve certain things. You see, he does not have to go to the Chamber of Commerce to ask with whom he should consort to satisfy his desires. In a mysterious way, he is drawn to the right people. These strong desires at once occupy the stage of the new person and will govern his whole life. We see how, in this situation, one person may seek one thing, another person will seek a different thing. Now, while these prarabdha karmas are occupying our mind, governing our actions, making us behave in a certain way, it goes without saying that they do not necessarily form all the karmas that we have. Many other tendencies and desires have remained quietly in the unconscious mind. These are classified under the heading of sanchita, meaning accumulated or stored. They are not coming to the forefront to govern our conscious life. They are like the suits a person keeps in his closet. Many desires which give individuality to ourself in every life are remaining untouched deep down in the mind. The third group of karmas is called kriyamana or agami. Agami means future, yet to come. That is to say, between these stored up karmas and the active karmas is another group which are pretty close to our conscious life. They have not erupted into our conscious life yet, but neither are they far off, and probably in the next life they will have precedence. Or even now, if proper opportunity comes, these agami karmas may come forward and occupy our conscious life. According to another, the third group is called kriyamana, or being formed. How being formed? Now, it is true your conscious life is being directed and dominated by the karmas which were in the motive for this birth. But that does not mean you're only repeating certain things from the past. You're doing many new things. Although the general tendency of our life is determined by the prarabdha karmas, we still have some freedom. And therefore, according to the kind of action we undertake, either good or bad karma is produced. That is to say, there is a fringe of freedom in this respect. We are not mechanically determined by our past. So this subject of karma is vast and implies many things about our past, about our future, how things will happen. There's a whole science which comes along at this point, which determines or which forms our attitude to these things. What should we do? How should we do it? How did we get where we are? How do we go from here? So the subject is vast and the subject is complicated. But the point is, there is a special Purusha, a Purusha Vishesha, a special being. That is that divine principle, that divine reality, that divine consciousness, which, as it were, hands down to us a life-saving rope, a life-saving tendency. And if we follow that tendency, if we go along the path that leads in that direction, all these things slowly become adjusted, slowly become regulated, and the basic tendency again begins to assert itself. That basic tendency is that we will realize that which is infinite, because what is infinite is at the very core of our being. We will experience that divine consciousness, that unlimited reality. That is our future. That, you could say, that is our fate. We cannot escape that. Temporarily, certain things happen to make us deviate from the path to that ultimate inner infinity, inner consciousness, inner perfection. And though we may be disturbed from it in this life, and we will get another opportunity, the next life may provide us with a better chance. And even if it doesn't, there are tendencies which we gravitate to if we have that strong inner desire for understanding, for realization, for fulfillment, for perfection. Ultimately, there is nothing that can resist that, because that is the very heart of reality. At the very core of things is our inner perfection, which can never be clouded for a very long time. Temporarily, it may not be available to us in a practical sense. Temporarily, we may be turned into an unhelpful direction. But there is no possibility that that ultimate perfection, that ultimate reality, that infinity, that oneness, there's no way that can disappear. That is at the very core of our existence. Sometimes it can be ignored, sometimes it can be even worked against. But ultimately, that infinity that is our very nature must reassert itself. And that is the message of all religions, and that is the message especially of Vedanta. Thank you.